101, the hits.
Hello, and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is for English learners. So we speak a bit slower, and we use words and sentences especially written for people learning English. Here are the stories we have for you on today's program. Dr. Jill Robbins brings us the education report. She talks about how 2020 was difficult for teachers and students. Alice Bryant brings us a story about a baby elephant and the efforts to save it. I will return with this week's words and their stories. We will finish our 30 minutes together with The Making of a Nation, our ongoing U.S. history program. But first, here is Dr. Jill Robbins.
At the beginning of 2020, the problems faced by American schools and colleges included issues like slavery, school shooting, sexual assault, and the use of technology. That all changed in March. The coronavirus pandemic sent students and teachers home, forcing schools in the U.S. and around the world to move classrooms online. Asha Choksi is head of research for Pearson Education. She saw the move to online learning as a chance to improve higher education. What it's done is, it's actually given a lot more power to students in terms of how, when, and where they learn, she said. However, Stephanie Hall of the policy research group, the Century Foundation, argued that online education can never really replace in-person learning in fields like healthcare and teaching. Hall said students need to experience what it is they're learning about, reading about, or hearing about in the classroom. And I don't know yet the degree to which technology can facilitate that. The health crisis also made it difficult for international students to stay in the United States. And it prevented U.S. students from studying in other countries. Brian Alexander is a professor at Georgetown University. He said the experience could push more colleges to develop online education. He warned, however, that might not happen if students have poor online experiences or if the coronavirus fades into being just another flu strain. As the year went on, it became clear that low-income communities and students in rural areas were not equipped for online education. Only half of the students in the city of Philadelphia had computers and home internet service. It took some time, but officials and businesses finally stepped in to provide equipment and service. In rural areas of South Carolina, without internet service, the state sent buses equipped with Wi-Fi internet to help. Students around the world faced similar problems. UNESCO reported in April that only half of the world's learners could take part in distance learning. In places like Bangladesh and Afghanistan, lack of electricity and internet service kept students from continuing their studies at home. Many countries, including Sri Lanka, Colombia, Ecuador, Chile, and Haiti, used radio and television broadcasts to provide education for at-home students. Diana Lopez is a teacher in Funza, a town near Bogota with 10,000 public school students. She said, "The radio lessons give children a space to develop their reading and writing skills and also show them that their teachers are still with them." Educators, however, worried about the mental health of students who could not attend school or see their friends. Frank Chen is a psychiatrist who has worked with college-age young adults. He said college can be a difficult experience for students with or without mental health issues, as they balance work, studies, and personal relationships. A major event like the pandemic makes it very difficult to predict what the long-term psychological effects might be. I don't think that there's another event in the history of the people who are alive now that can really measure up to this, said Chen. In the state of Virginia, fifth grade teacher Aileen Watts said she and other teachers built in activities to help students reduce anxiety. Classes took brain breaks, which meant stopping the lesson to play a short game or even do a dance. And if a child was feeling anxious, he or she could partner with someone to help calm those emotions. In August, parents, teachers, and politicians debated on whether U.S. schools should reopen. Meanwhile, schools in countries where the pandemic was under more control, such as in Europe, South Korea, and Vietnam, were able to reopen successfully. As U.S. schools reopened, the tragic result was the death of teachers and infection of children with COVID-19. In the state of Mississippi, there were 604 cases among school teachers and workers by mid-September. Randy Weingarten is president of the American Federation of Teachers. She said, "If community spread is too high, as it is in Missouri and Mississippi, if you don't have the infrastructure of testing, and if you don't have the safeguards that prevent the spread of viruses in the schools, we believe that you cannot reopen in person." I'm Jill Robbins.
And now, here is Alice Bryant.
Mana Siriwat has performed many attempts to save lives in his 26 years as a rescue worker in Thailand. But he had never tried to do so for an elephant. That changed when Mana was called into action after a motorcycle hit a baby elephant. The small animal was crossing a road with a group of wild elephants in the eastern area of Chanthaburi. Mana began trying to save the animal as soon as he could. Someone nearby took a video, which quickly went viral on social media. During the rescue, Mana gave two-handed compressions to the small elephant, which was lying on its side. His co-workers treated the injured motorcycle rider a few meters away. Both the rider and elephant are recovering, and neither has serious injuries. "It's my instinct to save lives," but I was worried the whole time because I can hear the mother and other elephants calling for the baby, Mana told Reuters reporters over the phone. Mana has dealt with several road traffic accidents involving humans. The elephant was the only victim he has been able to save while performing cardiopulmonary resuscitation, or CPR. When the baby elephant starting to move, I almost cried, he said. To help the baby elephant live, Mana had to estimate where an elephant's heart would be. He did so based on where the human heart sits in the body and based on a video he had seen online. The young animal stood up after about 10 minutes and was taken to another area for treatment. Workers then brought the elephant back to the place of the accident in the hope of reuniting it with its mother. The group of elephants returned, Mana said, when the mother heard her baby calling out. I'm Alice Bryant.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English.
Every word has its own story. Where did it come from? How did it get into the language? Today's word is Shenandoah. Hundreds of years ago, a Native American chief named Shenandoah lived with his tribes in what is now the state of Virginia. Little is known about Shenandoah, but in some way the soft sound of his name was given to a river. The Shenandoah River still flows in a deep valley between the Allegheny and Blue Ridge Mountains, just as it did when Chief Shenandoah lived. It is a slow-moving river, soft and as beautiful as its name. There are some word experts who believe the word Shenandoah means spruce river, because the waters of the river run through great forests of spruce trees. And this explanation could be correct. However, there is an old Native American story which is far more beautiful than that of the experts. Long ago, centuries before Europeans came to the New World, there was a great lake of sparkling blue water hidden in the mountains of Virginia. This lake was 250 kilometers long and 50 kilometers wide. For hundreds of years, Native American tribes lived near this lake, feeding on the fish from its clean waters. The Native Americans often climbed up the mountains and camped there during their long hunts for food. In the evenings, they sat near their camp and looked down at the beautiful lake. On a clear, starry night, you could see thousands of stars shining and dancing on the water below. The Native Americans loved this lake, and because they could see the stars in it, they called the lake Clear Daughter of the Stars. In their language, the word for this was Shenandoah. One day, there was a loud crashing sound at one end of the lake. The lake started to disappear. Its water ran out of the valley through a break in the mountainside. The waters ran on and on until they joined another river, which today is known as the Potomac. At last, the lake was gone. In its place was only a river. It is this way today. The lake is gone, but the beautiful Shenandoah River runs on. And on a clear night, anyone in the mountains can still see the stars dancing on the water. Shenandoah National Park
has just over 80,000 hectares of protected lands. The park has cascading waterfalls, beautiful mountain vistas, and serene woods. Located outside of Washington, D.C., the Shenandoah National Park is a popular getaway for people wanting to hike, picnic, or nature watch. Millions of Americans have seen the Shenandoah and have talked about it. And some years ago, someone wrote a song about it. Shenandoah is perhaps one of America's most recognizable folk songs. Some say the song refers to the river. Others say it is about the daughter of Chief Shenandoah. Regardless of what the song is about, Shenandoah remains an American classic. And that brings us to the end of this episode of Words and Their Stories. I'm Anna Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Morris Joyce and Frank Oliver continue the story of the man who served as America's 22nd and 24th president, Grover Cleveland.
Grover Cleveland began his second presidency in 1893. His two terms were separated by the presidency of Benjamin Harrison. Cleveland took office again just as the United States was entering an economic depression. Businesses failed. Banks closed their doors. Workers lost their jobs. And farmers lost their farms. President Cleveland believed the depression was caused by the government's money policy. At that time, both gold and silver were used to support the value of the American dollar. In Europe, however, only gold was used. American investors and bankers were afraid their money would drop in value because of the use of silver. They began exchanging their money for gold. President Cleveland wanted to return to the gold standard, too. To do this, he had to urge Congress to kill a law which forced the government to buy silver. Before Congress began its debate, the president discovered a cancer in his mouth. The cancer needed to be removed immediately, but the operation had to be kept secret. News that the president's life was in danger could have an effect on the debate. It could make the nation's economic crisis worse.
So, the operation was done on a private boat in New York Harbor. Doctors removed some of President Cleveland's teeth and much of his upper left jaw. Then they removed the cancer. The operation took only a half hour. After a few weeks, doctors made Cleveland a new jaw out of hard rubber. He wore it without difficulty. A newspaper printed a story about the operation. But administration officials denied it. The facts did not become public for many years.
When President Cleveland returned to Washington, he sent a message to members of Congress. He urged them to kill the law which forced the government to buy silver. He noted how people throughout the nation had been exchanging their paper money and silver for gold. He said he was afraid the federal treasury would soon run out of gold. Then it would have only silver to support the dollar. If that happened, he said, the United States no longer could claim to be a major nation. President Cleveland said, "The people of the United States have a right to a money recognized as such on every exchange and in every market of the world. Their government has no right to injure them by financial experiments that are opposed to the policies of other nations."
After the president's message was read, the House of Representatives began its debate. A young congressman from Nebraska spoke in opposition to the president's position. His part in the debate made him famous throughout the nation. His name was William Jennings Bryan. Bryan said the United States should continue to make and use both gold and silver money. Using only gold, he said, increased the value of the dollar, and that made life difficult for America's farmers and workers. They had to pay more to borrow money, and for farmers, a more valuable dollar meant lower prices for crops. Bryan described the situation this way. On one side of the debate stand the business interests of the United States. On the other side stand the unnumbered masses. Work-worn and covered with dust, they make their appeal. But too often, their cry for help has sounded hopelessly against the outer walls, while others, less deserving, find easy entrance to the halls of Congress. The president is wrong to act on the demand of the business interests. He can no more judge the wishes of the great mass of our people by the words of these middlemen than he can measure the ocean's silent depths by the foam upon its waves.
No other congressman spoke as well as William Jennings Bryan. Yet his words could not save the silver purchase law. The House of Representatives approved President Cleveland's proposal to kill the law. The Senate did too. The United States was firmly on the gold standard. Everyone, especially President Cleveland, waited for the economy to improve. It did not.
More businesses failed. More workers lost their jobs. Tens of thousands of men left their homes to look for work. Some of these men began to unite in protest groups they called industrial armies. One industrial army was organized by a man named Jacob Coxey. Coxey proposed that the federal government should hire unemployed men to build roads. He said the government could borrow enough money to pay each man $1.50 a day. Coxey decided to take his proposal to Washington. He also decided to take his industrial army with him.
Coxey's army marched many kilometers from Ohio to Washington. Hundreds of unemployed men joined in along the way. But by the time the army reached the Capitol, only 300 men remained. City officials barred Coxey's army from meeting on public property. They barred them from asking people for food or money. Jacob Coxey was ready for the worst. He said, "If my men starve in the streets of Washington, the smell of their bodies will force Congress to act." Coxey tried to read a protest statement at the Capitol building. Police stopped him. The protesters then pushed forward in what police later called a riot. Several of the men, including Coxey, were arrested. A judge found Coxey guilty of violating public property. He sent him to jail for 20 days. Without Coxey's leadership, his army broke up. Its members went home. Yet, the economic and social pressures which created Coxey's army did not ease. Protests and strikes continued throughout the nation.
The biggest strike started in Chicago against the Pullman Company, which made railroad cars. The man who owned the company, George Pullman, also owned the town where his workers lived. He owned the stores, the houses, the schools, and the library. When the economic depression began in 1893, George Pullman cut the size of his workforce. Those still working received less pay. Yet, Pullman did not reduce the cost of rent for his houses. Anyone who protested lost his job.
In the spring of 1894, a labor union organizer went to George Pullman's town. He was Eugene Debs, leader of the American Railway Union. Pullman did not want his workers to belong to a union, but he did not stop them at first. More than 4,000 workers joined. Immediately, the new union members voted to go on strike against the Pullman Company. Other members of the union supported them. They agreed not to work on trains that included Pullman cars. Within a few days, 60,000 railway workers were on strike. 20 railroads were closed down. Union leader Eugene Debs attempted to keep the strike peaceful, but he could not control strikers all over the country. So, railroad companies asked the federal government for troops to break the strike.
The request involved a legal point. America's Constitution says federal troops cannot be sent to a state unless the state government asks for them. And no state government had asked for them. President Cleveland met with his cabinet to discuss the railroad company's request. They finally agreed to send federal troops to Chicago, where the strike had started, to enforce federal postal laws. The troops would protect trains carrying mail. The arrival of the troops led to more violence. Eugene Debs and other leaders of the American Railway Union were arrested. The Pullman strike ended.
President Cleveland faced increasing political problems. Organized labor denounced him for using federal troops to break up the Pullman strike. Farmers and Westerners attacked him for opposing the use of silver money. And everyone blamed him for not doing more to end the Depression. These political problems would have a great effect on the next presidential election.
And that is our program for today. Thank you for listening. Join us again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Ana Mateo.